In the summer, I tend, as I mentioned a couple of times, I tend to kind of wander about, pick out random things that have been floating through my brain for a little while. We kind of step away from our normal kind of series structure, and I just pick up some sort of random threads or things that have just been sitting with me for a while and kind of go, might go a little bit off-piste, you know, but I hope that there's something valuable in what I've been sharing these past few weeks. Really loved what Elisa shared last week. That was really, really great. Where are you, Elisa? There you are. Fabulous. Really, really good. I want to begin with the words of the Gospel according to Matthew, two chapters. Beginning in chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, really famous words. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything, but it's thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." And then picking up in chapter 13, Jesus says, he put before them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It's the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches." He told them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until all of it was leavened." So obviously today I want to talk about pirates. So this, you knew that was coming. You knew that was coming. So today's message is called Raise a Black Flag. Now, any of you who cast your mind back, is it 5 weeks? Is it 6 weeks? Amanda, where are you? Have we stopped shaking yet? Are you still? have we got over it yet? Our holiday club, as you may well recall this year, was all pirate-themed, Treasure Island sort of themed. It was really good fun. And I must admit, I do love pirates. My mum will confirm, my favourite toy when I was a little lad was the Playmobil pirate ship. I had the Playmobil pirate ship. It was an absolute, I think I got it for about like my 9th or my 10th birthday, or 17th birthday. No, it was my 9th or 10th birthday, 23rd birthday. It was somewhere around then. And I loved it. I adored this pirate ship. And I say that the holiday club, there were many challenging, tiring things. There were many challenging things about the holiday club, weren't there, Amanda? But dressing up as a pirate, for me, was not one of them. Frankly, 4 days dressed up as a pirate. I think, frankly, I would spend every weekend. If Joe would let me, I'd spend every weekend. I would not spend every weekend. Definitely not do that, dressed as a pirate. That would be a silly thing to do. Okay. So I love pirates. I'm interested. I love pirate movies and fiction and all that sort of stuff. I love the history and, you know, particularly the golden age of pirates, you know, the Caribbean pirates and all that sort of stuff. I love it. So that was great fun to do that in the holiday club. And today I want to talk a little bit about what's been kind of rattling through my brain and why I kind of like it and what the connection might be to the passages that we were just going through. And I appreciate, you know, I know history. I've got a degree in history. I understand. I'm going to be painting history with very broad brushstrokes here. There's always another side. There's always a bigger story. I do understand that. But I just want to pick out a few facts about the historical pirates and why I find them so interesting. You've got to remember, we're talking about the golden age of piracy, somewhere from about 1650 to about 1720, something like that. And the society then was incredibly brutal. Incredibly unjust. Yes, pirates did some pretty shameful, awful things, but the society they lived in was incredibly violent, incredibly brutal, incredibly unjust. You know, slavery was a respectable middle-class investment. You know, so if you were thinking about what to put your ISA into or something like that, you know, all slavery. There's a lot of, you know, it was that sort of society. People made a lot of money from really awful things. The standard way that the Navy, the military Navy and the merchant Navy, the standard way that they recruited crews was to send gangs of armed thugs around the port towns or anywhere, basically, and like drug people, bash them over the head, basically kidnap people, because no one wanted to go to sea. It was incredibly dangerous, incredibly brutal. So they had to kidnap people to go to sea. They had to, and then when they were at sea and they became seamen, they were very rarely paid. The conditions were absolutely dreadful. It was a really, really bad environment to be in. And when some of these people broke away and became pirates, kind of made their own way, they were essentially creating communities that were more equitable. Rather than the kind of brutal discipline that they found in the Navy, they actually had, you know, everyone had a say and everyone got the share, a fair share of the profits and the money and all that sort of thing. One historian puts it like this: Golden Age pirates may have been thieves, but they were also incidental pioneers of social and political equality, fair pay, health insurance, workplace injury compensation schemes, etc., etc. It's all true. Instead of the vicious naval discipline, they had flatter hierarchies. The captain couldn't just whip whoever he liked, you know, flog them into almost death. They had to agree on the punishments that they all thought were fair. There were checks and balances. They were small and flexible crews that could combine together for big operations. You know, if you're into business speak, they were into agile before agile was a thing. Anyone heard of agile? Yeah, three of us got that joke. That's fantastic. All the signed up crew had a vote. Everyone had a vote, including women. There were a few women pirates. And non-white people, they had an equal... This is in the 17th century, in the 18th century. This was unheard of. According to estimates, up to a third of the average pirate crew would have been non-white. And they all had... I mean, that's... Talk about diversity targets right there. That leaves even, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers in the dust. You know, and everyone had an equal vote. This is unprecedented at that time. You know, Navy sailors were often left begging through violence, through injury, through the difficulties of that life. And pirates put aside plunder. There was a certain proportion of every, you know, haul, every bit of booty that was put aside to care for people once they were injured or couldn't work anymore, or even if they died, it went to their families. This was a contemporary writer, someone in the 1700s, said this: "I fear that they will soon multiply, for so many are willing to join with them when taken. The prospect of plunder and ready money, the food and the drink, the camaraderie, the democracy, equality and justice, and the promise of care for the injured." That was written by a government inspector looking into piracy in 1718. This is a terrible problem. They've got all this democracy and justice and shanties. I mean, who wouldn't want to join them? Arr! Well done, everyone. Arr! Shall I do the Pirate Club, the Holiday Club song again? Shall we? Later, if there's time. Now, of course... Oh, and they lived here, by the way. I mean, come on. Of course, pirates were not setting out for some sort of liberal society. They were not setting out to create a liberal society. They were simply solving the problems of their nasty, harsh world, making them a bit better for themselves. They were prepared to break the rules. They were prepared to innovate, to think differently. And there's something geographical about this. They're out on the margins. They're far away. There's a space out on the margins where new things can happen. They're in a new world, literally and figuratively. There's space. They're not constrained by the old ways, so new ways of being can come into effect. There's definitely a historical pattern, when you look through history, of powerful, radical innovation and revolution happening in small groups out on the margin. They have the space to create the necessary disruption that the system needs. You know, the system can become calcified and solid and too stuck in its ways. And out on the margin, there are different spaces, different voices, and new things can happen. The status quo gets challenged. Yes, they create trouble, but it can be good trouble sometimes. And plenty of people have recognized this in the centuries since. Here's a quote from Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple. He said right at the beginning of Apple's history, "I'd rather be a pirate than join the Navy." That was what he said in the first couple of years of Apple in a kind of gathering. Yeah, "I'd rather be a pirate than join the Navy." Here's another quote by Banksy. "The greatest crimes in the world are not committed by people breaking the rules, but by people following the rules." Think about it. Think about the worst crimes of the 20th century. The Final Solution, the concentration camps, Gulag Archipelago, the killing fields. These are people following the rules. These are people following the dictates of the higher power. So, and some of you be wondering, what is he talking about? When's he going to get to the point? So this is the point. This is the question. What is the church? Is the church the Navy or the pirates? What's your instant gut feeling? Someone said R. I'm loving the energy. Is the church the Navy or the pirates? Are we about the rules? Should we be about the establishment? Are we about the rules or are we about the revolution? What's your gut? What's your gut on this? When you think church, when society thinks church, when our culture thinks church, do you think they think Navy or pirates? Are we all about the rules? Are we all about the establishment? Are we all about guarding the status quo? Or are we about the revolution? Are we about the challenge at the margins? And now, a little bit of church history. Because I know that's what you were hungering for. And again, if you know a bit of church history, I'm painting with very broad brushstrokes here, but bear with me. There's a point to this. I want to illustrate the tendency for movements to become monuments. The history of the church is often a history of movements becoming monuments. So we look at the early church that Jesus founded, that the early apostles that we read about in Scripture founded. And this is a small, marginal group right out on the unfashionable end of the empire. You know, a backwater province of the Roman Empire. They're in a marginal space. And they have this group that's founded on grace and radical love, radical community. Read Acts. Enemy love. Not just love your friends, but love your enemies. Now, at the time that the church was establishing itself, the biggest religion, if you want to call it that, the biggest religion in the Roman Empire was the imperial cult, and it was for about 200-300 years following, and it sort of morphed into the cult of Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun. Basically the same thing. And they had temples, big stone temples, lots of columns, lots of gold, lots of statues. There was hierarchy. You had hierarchies of priests, you know, different people operating at different levels. They had gold, they had money, they had power. And then, very briefly, broad brushstrokes, the Emperor Constantine sort of adopted, decriminalized Christianity. The process is a little bit more complicated than that. But essentially, Christianity sort of came into the center from the margins. And I want to propose to you that Christianity basically rebranded the imperial cult. It rebranded the cult of Sol Invictus. So we get the early church plus the imperial cult becomes Christendom. So now the church is in the center. And the church, in fact, the same temples, in some cases, the same temples with the same columns, maybe they changed the statues a bit, then became cathedrals, became other churches, or they modified them a bit. Take Zeus away. We don't want him. Take Jupiter away. But, we'll put a cross there, They had the money, they had the power, they had the status, they had the hierarchy, cardinals, bishops, archbishops, etc., etc. And it becomes this thing that we call Christendom. That's the church and the state working together. You know, the church becomes an arm of the state. We do some of the tax keeping for the state. We do some of the kind of social glue that the state the church needs, registers of births, marriages, deaths, all that sort of thing. The church underwrites the state's wars. Yeah, because we're fighting for God, aren't we? We're all fighting for God. God's on our side, of course he is, when we go to war. The same Jesus who said, love your enemies, and et cetera, et cetera. So the church becomes an arm of the political state. That's what we call Christendom. So fast forward 1,500 years, and you get what's called the Protestant Reformation. And you have those people that you've heard of, like Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. Zwingli. Ulrich Zwingli. Isn't that the coolest name ever? That's a very heavy metal name. Ulrich Zwingli. Maybe you haven't heard of him, but you've heard of Luther and Calvin. And the kind of at the heart of the Protestant Reformation was people who were going back to the Bible. And they're saying, look, what does the Bible say about this? Because a whole bunch of practices and things had come in, and they're saying, but what does the Bible say about following Jesus? Let's go back to the Bible. And obviously, if you know anything, very broad brushstrokes, you can read all about this online. But that caused all sorts of conflict and war and struggle. And as a matter of expediency, all of those guys sort of partnered up with the states that they were part of, because they didn't want to get killed. So if there was a local kind of German prince or someone who was prepared to back them and look after them, that's what they did. So very early, you get the those reformers allying with the state power, and that's what we call the magisterial reformers. And it's basically the same again. It's the same as what was Christendom, the wider sort of Roman Catholic Church before that. But it just becomes localized, so you get, you know, the Lutheran Church is adopted in Germany, the Anglican Church in Britain. You know, it just becomes a localized version of Christendom power. They're still, you know, hand in glove with the state power, being an arm of state. And then we move on. And a couple of, and again, the history is a little bit more varied than this, but there were a couple of Zwingli students, and they said, look, now you've opened up this Bible thing, and we've started discovering Jesus, and we want to follow Jesus. You can't stop there. You can't slam the book shut. We want to go all in. And Zwingli's students became known as the Anabaptists, the rebaptizers, because they discovered this thing called believer's baptism. And that's what we call the Radical Reformation, which is why I said a few weeks ago, Baptists aren't technically Protestants, we're radicals, which is just cool, isn't it? Of course it is. They were about passionate discipleship, passionate delving into the Word, encountering the Holy Spirit, especially rooted in the words of Jesus. Now, I'm quite happy, quite proud, if that's not the wrong word, to be a Baptist with a small b. I'm not really into denominations, but in terms of Baptistic type of church, I'm all in. But in many ways, I mean, we're talking 400, 500 years ago. And again, once again, the history of this incredibly radical, I mean, all those guys, they were all killed. They were all killed in months or years, massacred by everyone. Protestants and Catholics all agreed on one thing. They all hated the Anabaptists, and they murdered them left, right, and center. It's a radical movement, incredibly costly. And yet, over the next 300, 400, 500 years, and you know, whatever movement you want to look at, the kind of purity revival of the 18th, 19th century, and yet all these movements start to lose their energy. They start to become the establishment. They start to do the same jobs that the established church does. And this is certainly not a case of one denomination being better than another, because equally, some of the established denominations have done incredibly radical things. The wind of the Spirit can bring new life anywhere. And some of those more established churches have done incredible things for God in that time. So it's certainly not a case of denominationalism. I think, you know, we're all kind of over denominationalism, really. What this is about is about the establishment being an incredibly seductive force. You know, size, power, legitimacy, success, budget. Wouldn't we all like those things? Is John our treasurer here? You know, a little bit more budget, a little bit more. If fundraising, a little bit more. You know, those things are incredibly seductive. When you're out on the margins, it can be a pretty tough place to be. Who wouldn't like to be accepted and seen as being legitimate and have success as quotes, you know? If you go to a minister's conference, you know, you start meeting, oh, hello, where are you from? What's it? And it's I'm right, Stuart, have you ever been to these conferences where it's not long in the conversation where it's, how big is your church? How many people are part of your congregation? And it's like, you kind of can't help but find yourself moving in that direction of the conversation, because we all have this unconscious sort of pegging hierarchy of what's what and how well, you know, things are going. The establishment, success, what the establishment judges as success can be incredibly seductive. But when you have those things, when you have size and you have power and you have wealth and you have status and you have a role to play, and we need to be standing up because we're the center of the community, we're a pillar of the community. When you have all those things, you can't have people out on the margins making it up as they go along. You need when you've got a big, it's like a big ship, you know, a big ship takes a long time to turn around, doesn't it? You can't have people just making it up as they go along. We need rules. We need guidelines. We need structures. We need rhythms, regulations. Big established things tend to play it safe. They tend to be naturally kind of conservative and prudent and rigid. And they need rules and regulations and structures. They tend towards conformity, and therefore a movement becomes a monument. So, here's the point. What might a church make of all this, do with this in 2023? That's my question for us today. Well, Jesus taught about mustard seeds. And he taught about yeast, tiny, tiny little yeast. Who makes bread? Anyone makes bread or made bread in the past? Isn't it wonderful when it starts to grow and it's proving, the proving loaf? Something really amazing happens. And he talked about salt. I'm not going to get into each of the metaphors in depth. I'm sure you've heard this stuff before. Salt, making things more flavorsome, preserving things, healing things. And he spoke about light. All of these things, everyday things to the folks that he was talking about, humble things, small things, but with the power to transform on a fundamental level, to create something utterly new, utterly transformative. These are not powerful sledgehammers of tools battering through the opposition. These are winsome, they are subtle, often overlooked, may be regarded as ordinary, but with the power to become extraordinary. And notice that all of these things work: mustard seeds, yeast, salt, light. They work because they are in contact with their environment. Think about it. You know, the mustard seed needs to be planted. Any gardeners here? You know, things need to go in the ground. They need to be nurtured. Yeast works because it's within the bread. Salt, it's no good in the salt cellar. It needs to be in the food. It needs to be in the water. If you've got an ulcer or something, you gargle with some salty water. You know, it needs to be in contact. And light, that's exactly Jesus's point. No one lights a light and then puts a basket over it. The light needs to be expanding. It needs to be in contact with the darkness. Otherwise, it's just not being light. It's not doing what it needs to do. And also, as I was contemplating this week, notice that at least a couple of those metaphors, they interact. You know, the yeast feeds on the dough. That's how the yeast leavens it. It's actually getting something from its environment. Same with the seed. When it's planted, it's being fed by the environment. There's a reciprocal interaction, a reflexive interaction. There's coming and going. There's to and fro. There's an interaction. They're in contact. They're in connection, in contact, and they're also interacting with their environment. But as I said, big organizations, they need conformity. They need everyone to fit in. They need everyone to follow the rules. This is what we do. We can't have random radical elements bouncing off the walls. Everyone needs to be alike. Everyone needs to agree. We all need to be on the same page about every little thing. And because that big organization can't tolerate difference gets pushed to the side. Difference gets pushed away because difference is disruptive. Can't we all just follow the rules? Difference is disruptive. It gets pushed away. It gets pushed to the side. And so the reaction of the church has usually been, with time, with size, with success, to build walls. Not to be in interaction, in connection with its environment, but to be building walls. And the holy, we've sung a lot about the holy today. I wonder what you think of when you think of the holy. And I wonder if it's the idea that I think most of us have about the holy. The holy is something that exists behind a wall. The holy is something pristine. It's clean. It's locked away. It's not touching. Oh, don't touch me. Don't make me dirty. It's something that exists in a glass case, in a museum, behind a rope. Don't get near it. Don't touch it. Is that your idea of the holy? The holy is super clean. It's super pristine. It's super, Do you remember the story of what happened when Jesus died on the cross? The holiest place on earth, the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Jerusalem, was exactly that kind of place, separated by concentric levels of courts which you couldn't enter into. And then finally, a final barrier, a great leather curtain separating the rest of the awful world from the Holy of Holies. And what happened to that curtain? Ripped from top to bottom. And people have all sorts of ideas about why that was. But for me, it's pretty simple. The holy was bursting out. The holy doesn't live in a pristine box, in a glass case, behind a rope anymore, or behind a curtain. The holy isn't behind a wall anymore. The holy is out there. The holy is on the loose. It's not clean. It's not pristine. It's not in a glass case. Joe Parnell. Is Joe Parnell here this morning? No. Hi, Joe. Joe was telling me a story this week about a little girl who went on camp and someone asked, and they'd done the story of the Good Shepherd, goes out, looks for the lost sheep. And someone asked the little girl, what did you learn in camp? And she said, Jesus picks up dirty sheep. Love that. That's brilliant, wasn't it? And like Joe was telling me, we always think about that he puts the little lamb on his shoulder, and we think of this beautiful, fluffy, white creature. Has anyone seen sheep? They're revolting. Sheep do not use toilet paper. That's another T-shirt slogan right there. We need to be producing these. Sheep don't use toilet paper. And Jesus picks up that lamb and puts it on his shoulder. Does that change the metaphor a little bit for you? Jesus picks up dirty sheep. I love that. At the shore, I believe we are all about connection. Because we can say, the holy is out there. The holy is out. The holy is on the loose. It's not contained behind the curtain anymore. The holy is out there. We could say, the holy is out there? Really? Because that needs to change our perception. We need to be about connection. We need to be about interaction. We need to be that yeast in the dough, that salt in the food. We are in so many ways, what we're doing with the Haven Project, with Renew, and with several other projects I'm really excited about that we're exploring at the moment, and various other things as well. Seeds in the ground, light in the darkness. I'm not interested in being the coolest show in town. I'm not interested in fairy lights and smoothie machines. As much as there's nothing wrong with those things, I'm not interested in the light show, the fireworks. I'm interested in the yeast and the salt and the light and the mustard seed growing in dark places. Small, humble things. Humble things. Silly things. Foolish things. Broken things. Like me? Like you? Being mixed up with the world, mixed up in the middle of it all, with all the mess, with all the wonderful, broken glory of it all, the mess. Being in and staying in relationship with one another, with our community. Yes, when things get complicated. Yes, with all the questions, all the doubts, all the stuff that we can't quite work through. But we're in it. We're in the mix. We don't break contact. We don't throw people under the bus. We stay together. We walk together like healthy families should, through thick and thin. And some people won't get it. You know, the natural reaction is, but what about the rules? What about the walls? Don't we need walls? Don't we need rules? Because we're so addicted to that way of thinking. And of course we like the walls. Of course we like the rules. We made them so that we were on the right side of them. Yes? Ever heard people roundly condemning a sin? Ever had people getting really, really worked up about a particular sin in their perspective? It's never a sin that they're susceptible to, is it? I often want to hear people say, well, we were getting together and we were telling, you know, that's wrong and this is wrong. It's like, why don't you talk about the other thing? Why don't we talk about gossip? Why don't we talk about slander? Why don't we talk about the sins that we all do? Why don't we talk about, because that's, you know, I'd rather talk about sin that isn't my problem, you know what I mean? Of course we like the rules. Of course we like the walls. We made them to be on the right side of them. They made us feel safe and they made us feel strong and they made us feel right. But Jesus broke the rules. Jesus was killed for a reason. Jesus was condemned by the religious machine. Jesus was condemned by the establishment. He was condemned by those who had rules and scriptures to back it up and walls to hide behind. Jesus started his revolution amongst the ordinary people on the edge of the empire, at the margins. And Jesus didn't yearn for palaces or wealth or power or armies or navies, if you can see where I'm going. He talked about salt and light and mustard seed and yeast. Because it's there, in those things, in these humble, everyday, wonderful things, that Jesus says something amazing, that something transformative can happen. He calls it the kingdom of heaven, heaven on earth. May we as a church embrace the radical. May we as a church embrace the amazing, untamed love and way of Jesus. May we not cling to the rules, but embrace the revolution. May we not hide behind walls, but get neck deep in the mess and the wonder of the holy. May we raise a black flag and say, we would rather be pirates than join the Navy. I'm going to pray now. I'm going to ask Simon and the band to come back and we'll worship. Lord, will you reveal to us where we have lost touch with the amazing transformative glory of your kingdom because we've been afraid, because we've wanted safety, because we've wanted security, because we've wanted status, because we've wanted conformity, because we've just wanted a quiet life. Lord, if we've become stuck, will you shake us free? If we've become risk averse, Lord, will you give us courage? Lord, if we've become dazzled by the light show, by the illusion of celebrity and success that our culture is so besotted by, will you show us the truth and the power and the wonder of everyday, ordinary, glorious, humble things? Yeast in the dough. Salt in the food, light in the darkness, growing seeds in the garden. Have your way with us, Lord Jesus. Amen.
Amen.